Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 313. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and we've got a small crew today, only three dudes. One of them is Guillaume Veillette.
Guillaume Perfect Attendance Veillette.
Yes. Very nicely done, sir. And joining us for the first time this week, we've got our Australian correspondent for Nintendo World Report, Nicholas Bray.
My main beam is ready.
Whoa.
Very nice. We're very happy to have you, Nick, and we're very much in need of the help this week. James is off watching sports, I think, which he does about once a year. I think it's a confluence of two different sports that he loves, and they're having special games on the same night. So I certainly could not begrudge him that. And of course, John is still out, but we do expect him back next weekend for the telethon, and hopefully back on the show regularly soon after that. But you will hear from John Lindemann very soon on the telethon, along with a lot of other people, and I'll talk about them at the end of this episode.
You know, I'll be honest, I didn't think that slam ball was still a thing.
Oh, man. Yes, and as I mentioned, we actually have some pretty crazy announcements and things, and if you've been watching the Twitter feeds and all, you might have seen some of these, but if you haven't, you're going to be shocked when you hear some of the guests and some of the content and just some of the craziness that's going on with the telethon. So I will give you more details about that at the end of the show. And we've got your listener mail coming up later as well, but first it's time for new business, and we have a number of interesting games to talk about this week. Guillaume is up first with a pretty cool little topic or two.
It's an all Nintendo new business once again, and that means that people are going to discuss Minecraft and Dark Souls in the podcast thread, but I'm not bitter. So I've been playing a little bit of the Mutant Muds DLC, the new stages that have been released for free by Renegade Kid. They are made for the grindy character that you unlock, spoilers, by beating the game. So how you access those levels? Well, you remember the Virtual Boy special stages. Yep. And Game Boy-looking special stages in the original. It's the same thing here. Most of the time, you'll have a not-so-well-hidden door that says CGA Land.
And CGA is the color graphics adapter. So that was a kind of graphics technology that came around, I think, the mid to late 80s for IBM computers. By today's standards, it looks pretty ghastly. Mm-hmm. Like kind of very neon looking colors, pink. I think like a lot of pinks and turquoise.
Yep.
VVVVVV actually has a kind of a CGA feel to it, although it's less garish and it has a couple of visual effects that you probably could not have done in CGA. But that puts you pretty close to, you know, an idea of what this probably looks like.
If you've played like 10D1000 games or whatever, like IBM yeah. compatible PCs back in the day, you'll definitely recognize the style. What is unfortunate is that that's pretty much the only distinguishing feature that those levels have in terms of presentation. There's no new music composed for these levels, and it doesn't sound any different than they usually sound.
Are there new level elements, or is it the same kind of moving platforms and spikes that you see in the regular game?
I've played 12 out of the 20 new levels, and so far it's all things that we've already seen, and enemies that we've already seen. So there are no new elements, and I gotta say, playing them in succession, they all look the same, and there's not really anything new that you're doing, really. The level design will be different because it does take advantage of the fact that Granny can hover longer and she can shoot up in the air at any time once with the jetpack. But it, you know, like we already did these things to a lesser degree in the original version of the game. So what happens is that you go through these levels. They pretty much always look the same, and they'll always be slight variations in the same motif. It's hard to explain, but there's nothing really tricky to it. And I found
You're just combining powers that you already have.
Yeah, and the difficulty doesn't really pick up where the original game left off, which is in a way a blessing, but also a problem. A blessing because the last stage of the original game was so hard and really a bitch to get through. And I'm not sure that people would really enjoy, you know, a difficulty level that picks up from there. At the same time, also, like, since you've mastered much more difficult challenges, playing through these stages is kind of a cakewalk.
Do the other levels ramp up to that difficulty later?
Well, as I said, I've played 12 out of the 20 levels. I think, you know, it might get much harder later on, but I've already seen people blow through them pretty quickly. Personally, because they're so kind of easy to get through, I'm thinking that I'm going to save those 8 levels later as kind of gaming comfort food. And I'm going to stop playing them for now. But yeah, like I don't want to be saying that the stages aren't good, or don't want to be complaining about, oh no, like free levels, come on. But it's not exactly a completely game-changing set of new challenges that you're getting.
It's more Mutant Muds.
Yeah.
That's all it is.
Yes.
But that's a good thing. It's one of the best games, you know, on 3DS, and I think it's awesome that they're doing this for free. But it does seem to me, I'm actually really happy to hear this, because I'm glad they're, you know, whatever ideas they had left within the mechanics of the first game, they're squeezing them out with this DLC, and they're kind of celebrating, hey, you've already mastered this game, now put all your skills together in slightly different ways and play a little bit more of it. But the fact that this is really just more of the same tells me that the sequel, which they've more or less announced for sometime in 2013, it is going to have to add new mechanics. It's going to have to do something different, because they can't just do more Mutant Muds, because they've already kind of done that in this free downloadable content.
Right. And even though Max was really versatile in the way that he had the jetpack, so he could hover and he could do different things other than just jump, he was not really that fun to control. You know, like he has, if you're not pressing forward, you're not going forward. You know, like he has no momentum to him unless you're on the ice. And so it's very, very exact. I don't know what I'm saying.
It's a good point.
So is it like Super Ghouls and Ghosts in the way it controls? I haven't played the game, so...
No, it controls better than Super Ghouls and Ghosts.
I would say perhaps Mega Man, or if you've played Gargoyle's Quest. Quest. But Gargoyle's Quest was not really praised for its platforming stages, or the platforming in its stages.
I disagree. I think the platforming is really good in Gargoyle's Quest, but it's also more complicated than anything you do in Mutant Muds, because Firebrand can stick to walls. So he can hover like the guy in Mutant Muds, but he can also stick to walls. And so they give you all kinds of like weird floating platforms you have to attach to the side of without touching spikes. And it's a little bit different style. It's a little bit more complex kind of platforming. Whereas Mutant Muds is very simple. It's more like, it's like vanilla Mega Man. It's like Mega Man with no powers. You know, it's jumping and shooting and walking.
Yeah, and much more simplistic combat, because Mega Man has enemies that actually have varied patterns for the most part.
Right.
And Mutant Muds, you see very few types of enemies, and they always have the same patterns. They never do anything unpredictable. But yeah, so, you know, I enjoyed them. I'm going to save some of them for later. I've also been playing another platformer, an eShop game that I've been playing for a review. And why is James not here to listen to this? It's called Too Fast for Gnomes. Oh. And you can bet your ass that 2 and 4 are numerals, and that gnomes is spelled G-N-O-M-Z. It's that kind of game. The kind of game that tries to be cute and clever and wacky, you know, and tries to sell on that. Except that the game is actually, you know, pretty decent. Like, I would have expected shovelware to be honest. But I had played the WiiWare demo. So yeah, this is an eShop game that's basically a remake of a WiiWare game that came out pretty late, I think, in WiiWare's life. Well, yeah, well after anyone stopped paying attention. And it's in the same mold, I would say, as a Bit Trip Runner. You're continually running to the right, but it's not randomly generated levels. They're actually designed, and they're designed around your abilities. And those abilities are introduced to you very, you know, one at a time, just like in Bit Trip Runner. But in a way, I think that they're kind of more interesting. You know, in Bit Trip Runner, the game is it's all based on rhythm. And you're always going at the same constant speed. And when the game introduces new abilities, you know, you couldn't go back to older levels and try them out to try different things. Because there's, you know, like those past levels simply didn't have the obstacles that those abilities would be useful against. In Too Fast for Gnomes, actually, the game kind of only takes off when you've got at least the three first abilities. Because they actually change the way that you do the platforming. If you press down, for instance, you'll dash through tree stumps, but you'll also be instantly pulled down on the ground. And if you press up, he just like picks up his tied underwear and floats with that. So, you know, that's a nice touch. And if you press forward, he actually speeds up. And the game is actually already super fast. But he speeds up and his jump is slightly lower, but also with a much wider arc. So, you know, while you can't really do the platforming to the rhythm of the music, and that's not really what the game is attempting, you do have a strange kind of freedom when you're jumping to, you know, on how you tackle each and every jump.
So does it feel like there's more than one way to beat a level?
Perhaps not to beat a level, but certainly to get across a chasm. You know, like you might decide, okay, you know what? I think I can pull off running over this one and do a long jump.
Hmm.
Or you might decide I'm going to play it safe and I'm going to press up and I'm going to float my way to the other side of the chasm. It's hard to describe, but there's certainly more freedom while you're in the air than you would have in the Bit Trip Runner. The game is not perfect, though. Like, the level design leaves something to be desired. The game goes so fast that you can't really see what's coming ahead, so there's a lot of memorization involved. If you're willing to deal with a lot of memorization and with the fact that the game isn't really fun immediately because you don't have all the abilities that you need to get through a level really, you know, in a fun way. But maybe it takes like maybe 30 minutes to unlock everything. So
that's too slow for funds.
Wow.
This sounds like it sounds like this game was made by people who have skill but no taste.
Yeah, that is probably accurate.
So I will go next in new business. We're giving Nick some time to warm up and get used to the show. And I've been playing this week, again, I wish James was here for a different reason than Guillaume did, but I've been playing XCOM Enemy Unknown. It is, you know, the brand new sort of revival of the XCOM franchise. And I've talked about the original XCOM on this podcast years ago. I bought it when it came out on Steam, and I think I got it for like $5. I think you can still get it for, you know, really, really cheap on Steam. And it's from the early to mid 90s. It's a very ambitious, very impressive game from a design standpoint. The tech is not that great, and the original XCOM has a very well-deserved reputation for being brutally difficult.
Oh, I've played the first hour so many times.
Yeah, me too.
And at some point, like, I just lack funding because I've been unable to protect countries, so they just like pull out of the whole project, XCOM project, and
yeah, and then things
it's
just
game over.
Yep, everything kind of mounts up very quickly at once you get to a certain point.
Yeah,
and then it goes real bad. So the original XCOM had this almost kind of roguelike feel to it because it felt like you weren't going to beat it. The goal was to survive as long as possible, you know, and over time you would sort of learn how to prioritize certain things. But there was a lot of randomness in the missions that they would give you. Sometimes they would just plop a mission in your lap that was insanely hard, and there was no way you're getting out of that thing alive. I don't care what you've done up to that point. So it had this like it had so many alluring, mysterious, exciting elements to it. I mean, it's a game and it's a tactical strategy game, very similar to a Tactics Ogre, Final Fantasy Tactics, something like that. Even I would say Fire Emblem or Advance Wars, those are similar as well in their own ways. But you're moving around these troops and you're shooting at aliens. And so it has this sci-fi aspect to it that a lot of these other games don't have. These strategy RPGs are very often fantasy-based. So this one works very much the same way. There's elevation, there's line of sight, there's fog of war. It has a very creepy atmosphere to it because you're fighting aliens in the dark. And they're very dangerous and you don't understand them and they may throw weapons at you that you've never seen before. But the really awesome thing, and this game would be too stressful, it would be too difficult, it would be just too scary to play if it was only strategy. It would just be a little too intense, I think. What they do is they give you this really, really strong carrot on the stick, which is that if you manage to survive the mission, you take back to your base all of the alien remains, all of their weapons, the ruins of their UFOs that you shot down. So you come back with all this crazy technology and all these artifacts and knowledge about the aliens. And then you assign researchers to research all of this stuff and turn it into new weapons and new armor and new technology and abilities that you can go and use against the aliens the next time you fight them. So it's a very unusual game in that it combines this very detailed, hardcore tactical strategy game with a kind of a simulation, like a base building simulation where you're managing money, you're managing time, you're managing people, your scientists and your engineers who have to research and build this stuff for you, and your soldiers as well. And so you're juggling all this stuff in between the missions. And the really cool thing is that the missions and the stuff you do between the missions interact so much with each other, and you have to be good at both. You have to, and if you're not good in one, then maybe you can use the other to make up for that a little bit, or maybe it just all goes to shit. So the new one, this all goes for the original game from the 90s, but the new XCOM, it all applies to that as well. It's very, very faithful to that formula. And that's what I love about it, is that it totally captures the magic and the mystique of XCOM that I had when I played it at friend's house, on PC way back then, 20 years ago. And it brings all that into a modern environment without really changing very much about the mechanics of it. It looks different. It looks like a modern game, but it plays almost exactly the same way. And yet it still is so fresh and so addictive and so well balanced. I think it just really speaks to how great of an idea this was, in the first place. Mm-hmm. And it still totally works. I've had an incredible time with it so far, and I just only wish that I could put four times as many hours into it as I have so far, but I've just been too busy. I think it's a game that James would absolutely adore, and I think a lot of people would adore it, and there's plenty of heritage and games that have either influenced the original XCOM or have been influenced by the original XCOM that you can play on Nintendo platforms, even, Fire Emblem, that we did for Retroactive a few months ago.
Yeah, or I was going to mention, if you have played the Ghost Recon game on 3DS, that was made by people behind the original XCOM.
Right.
And, except that it's kind of the tactical missions, without the whole simulation aspect.
Right. And as good as the tactics are, and they are really good, I think the simulation is really the secret sauce that makes it so much better, and it makes it so much more than the sum of its parts because they interact with each other back and forth, those two halves of the game. Yeah. So, and that stuff, it's a very different kind of stress that they put on the player, because now it's not life or death. It's not, well, if I peek around this corner, then I'm going to get shot at. Now it's, I have to make these decisions. And if I put my money into the wrong thing, then an hour down the road, I might really pay the price for it. So I have very limited resources, and I really have to choose wisely what I'm going to put those to. So it's still important, and it's still an intense process of managing that simulation, but it's a different kind. And so you don't get overly worn out from doing the same thing over and over again. The game is really well written. It's fun to look at. It's super fun to play. I'm playing it on PC, but with an Xbox controller, and it works great. So if you only have a console, no problem. It's a very simple interface, and it works really well with a controller, even though it's a, you know, originally a PC franchise. Mm-hmm. And I think people should check it out. It's probably one of the best games this year. It's really awesome.
You know, I was kind of interested in it, but again, like I'm really trying to finish the games I actually already own before getting new ones. And not only do I have Ghost Recon not finished, but I also have Rebel Star Tactical Command.
Also made by the people who worked on XCOM.
Yes, probably one of the oldest games in my backlog.
Yeah, that's from GBA, right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Still untouched. Yeah. It was one of the very last GBA games, I think, of like worth mentioning to be made.
Yeah. Well, you should. I've never played Rebel Star. I always kind of wanted to. You should go check that out. Play a little bit of it. You know, make sure you get your money's worth out of Ghost Recon, and then I think you should jump to XCOM because it's going to do the same things those games do, but with the simulation aspect, it's really on a whole different level.
Yeah.
And it gives it this kind of RPG flavor that is really special, and it's just awesome. So and I also wanted to note they have balanced the game much better than the original XCOM. It's much easier to play. It's much less intimidating to get into. There's a nice tutorial that sort of slowly gives you more and more freedom, and then at some point they unshackle you. Not that far, like maybe an hour into the game, they just completely remove the shackles and let you do whatever you want, and that is scary because there's a lot of choices you can make, and you're not sure what all of them do, but it is much, much less intimidating than the original XCOM. And I'm playing on the normal difficulty. The hard difficulty is called classic. So they're really acknowledging that the original game was really, really hard, and you can still play at that level if you want to, but the default normal setting is a step below that. And I think there's an easy as well. So it's much easier to get into, but even on normal, it absolutely has that magic that was so exciting to me when I played the original almost 20 years ago. So I'm just thrilled about XCOM. This is exactly what I wanted it to be, and I think they totally pulled it off.
But do we think that there's any chance that it might come to the Wii U? Or?
Yes. I think so. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. It'll be some kind of like Batman style game of the year edition, but I think it very well could come out on Wii U next year. And it would be really nice. I can think of a lot of things in this kind of game where it's turn-based. So, you know, you can really take your time on the touchscreen to do things. I think that would be potentially very, very useful. Cool. So I can think of a lot of things they could do on that. But the other game I played this week is just more of Final Fantasy V Advance. And this will probably be the last time I bring it up, but it's a long game. I'm still not finished with it. I played over 20 hours of it, and I'm more than halfway through it, I think. And I just wanted to follow up on a couple of points from last week. First off, as you might have seen from the chapter art that Guillaume put in for last episode, I did break down and hook up my Game Boy Player after all. Not because I felt it was inadequate on the DS Lite, I just was curious. I hadn't used the Game Boy Player in many years, and I was just kind of wondering, like, does it still look good? You know, and it looks fine. It works really well. I'm playing with a WaveBird, which is kind of funny because it is nice to have the wireless controller, but the D-pad really sucks.
Yeah.
So, you know, just in general for GameCube, the D-pad's not very good. But again, it's an RPG. It doesn't really matter. You know, it's not an action game. So, I think it's fine for that. The music definitely sounds better coming out of my TV than it does out of the DS Lite speakers. So if you're not going to use headphones very much, then that's a nice upgrade to play it through your TV. And, it looks fine. You know, the Game Boy Player was pretty easy to set up. As for the game, it continues to be really good. I'm enjoying it more and more. And one thing I wanted to follow up from last week is I had mentioned that it seemed pretty easy, you know, kind of similar to the US version of FF4, mm-hmm. also known as FF2 on Virtual Console. Buy it now. But it actually has ramped up a little bit. And I think it's getting more difficult as you go, which is a good thing, because of course you're learning the game systems better, but also because you have so many tools in your set from being able to change jobs on the fly, that if you run into a situation that's too difficult for you, there's probably 100 different things you could think of to do that might give you a better chance. You know, if you say, I just need to go back in there with summoning. If I can summon monsters, then I'll have the advantage. And a lot of times that's enough, you know. Or, well, I need to switch this black mage to a red mage, and that way I can use healing when I need to. And that'll give me just enough to get through it. So there's lots of choices, lots of options, and you really have a large tool set. The characters have continued to be pretty interesting. Some of the supporting characters are really funny. The localization, I mean, this is the best localization that Square has done for this particular game. Still has a couple of odd points. There's a point where a character says, "You're harshing my buzz." I was a little surprised by that. Yeah, that's the Gilgamesh character. He comes up. He's kind of vaguely referenced in FF6, but you're not really sure. If you haven't played 5, you won't really get it. You won't really know what he's referring to, but he plays the sort of Ultros role. So he's this recurring comic villain. And you fight him, and every time you fight him, he ends up running away at the end. So it's like you never really completely finish him off. But he keeps coming back and nagging you at different story events, and he's pretty funny. Pretty funny. But yeah, I've had a really good time with it, you know, and one of the funny things about it is when you first start FF5, if the whole first 5 or 10 hours of the game feels very accelerated, it's like, wow, I moved from chocobo to ship to black chocobo to airship in a very short condensed period of time. And I was thinking, like, this is weird, because to me, roaming the map and, you know, like very slowly improving your mode of transportation is one of the appeals of Final Fantasy. It's like, you know, feeling like you're moving through the world very slowly, and then something big happens, and now you have this amazing new ability to go to places you could never get to before, and it all becomes much more convenient.
Right.
I don't want to spoil anything in case someone is planning on playing FF5 in the future, but they find ways to reset your access to those modes of transportation. So it's not like they just crank it to 11 right off the bat and then they remove all that aspect. There's definitely plenty of still wandering around the overworld on foot, looking for things, and even the locations early in the game feel very simple. You know, the caves that you go into are like never more than 2 screens. The castles are very easy to navigate. There's very few secret passages. And that also, I think, ramps up slowly over the course of the game, and the environments that you have to get through become more complex as you get more used to it. So, I'm fine with it overall. I think it's a little bit different than some of the other Final Fantasy games I've played, but it makes sense now that I'm deep enough into it that I can see the progression. Yeah, so it's still really good, and I'm gonna keep playing it. But it'll probably be a while before I beat it, so I'm not gonna keep talking about it every week. I mean, it is Final Fantasy; it's not that unusual for the franchise. But I'm really, really glad that I finally picked this up and started playing it. And really, I have you to thank, Guillaume.
Hey, not a problem.
You brought it up, and you lit the fire in my head that said, "Wait a damn minute, why did I never play that game?" So I'm very thankful. Appreciate it. And now we're going to move on to our guest, Nick Bray.
Yes, okay, this week I decided to play Mario Party 9 in solo mode.
Why? Why?
You don't like Mario Party 9?
Did you just say solo mode?
Oh, I had to. I didn't have anyone to play with this week, so... I played it when I bought it. I played it with some friends for about... you know, a couple of hours or so, but I was about the only one that was sort of into it. Everyone else was sort of put off by the fact that the game had changed so much since the previous ones, but I didn't like the fact that everyone was sort of moving at the same to the same squares and stuff, and just the sort of the way the game progression works now, in a more linear sort of board. They didn't like. I'm right. Still in two minds about it as well. I sort of miss the more simple, like the standard board game structure, but at the same time, playing in solo mode, it's a bit easier to get through. Like, it's a bit less frustrating in a way.
Less frustrating, but is it more fun?
Well, I played a board yesterday and won this. Most of it won this morning, but I couldn't say it was all that fun. No, the mini games were are probably the best the series has seen for a long time. I just ended up playing going to free play and playing a bunch of mini games by myself this morning to sort of jog my memory and to sort of what they were like and stuff as well. But I would need to play it with my friends again and sort of hopefully they would be more into it, because we used to play the past Mario Party games back on the 64 and the GameCube quite a bit. It was, you know, I used to see them like at least once every weekend, and would probably put in one of the Mario Parties at some point each weekend. So I have a fair bit of experience playing in multiplayer. You know, it's pretty funny playing Mario Party at like 3 a.m. in the morning and then doing the 50-turn board game, you know, like it takes about 6 hours, but it's pretty funny by the end.
God. Wow.
6 hours of Mario Party. Oh, man.
It's like more like a test of endurance, because by the time you get to the last, you know, 15, 20 turns, like, people are falling asleep, so you can sort of get the advantage.
Do you guys also challenge yourselves to desert bus marathons or what?
Yeah, that was on the Sundays every week.
That was the other game. No, I mean, come on, Mario Party is great. 50. I don't know that 50 turns should ever be part of the equation, but
I wouldn't advise doing it regularly. But you know, once or twice, just for the experience.
So then it wasn't, when you first got it, it wasn't that your friends weren't interested in Mario Party. It's just that they were a little turned off by the modernization of Mario Party 9.
Yeah, they were a little bit turned off by that. And also the fact, well, you know, we haven't seriously played Mario Party since probably the GameCube, Mario Party 6 or so. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone's older now. I'm 25, so... And Borderlands had just come out, so they were more interested in talking about Borderlands than sort of playing Mario Party at the time.
That's fair. I think... Not that it's not for all ages, but I think there probably is a phase that most people go through where they're really prime to play something like Mario Party, and then it's hard to recapture that later on.
It is, yeah. Sort of the fun for Mario Party comes from the interaction. If like three people are sort of just going through the motions and not really saying anything, it's going to be boring.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Now, Nick, had you played the Wii Party?
No, I skipped Wii Party. Yeah, I was considering getting it, but I just never got around to buying it. It was like $80, and it never came down.
Oh, geez. So yeah, I forgot about your crazy, crazy prices down there. there was only one board game type of game, and there was only one board. So, and it was basically the same formula as Mario Party. It was absolutely random who would end up at the top. Usually, like, the people who did the poorest at the mini games would win. Mm. But there were, you know, it was a mini game collection that had a little bit more meat to it, I think, than most Mario Party mini games. Right. And, there was, you know, some really fun stuff there. For instance, a game called Sput the Sneak, in which you all hold your Wiimotes, and someone's Wiimote is going to shake. That person is going to be the sneak. And then you all wander around on the screen, and you have to pretend that, well, you have to escape zombies in the graveyard, but one of the people is not being pursued by the zombies, but he has to pretend that he is. And at the end, everyone has to vote on who they think the sneak is. And so, you know, like, you have to do a good job at not getting caught by the zombies. You know, you can't just run into them, but also you have to pretend that it's a genuine risk and that they're going for you. So, yeah, it's a ton of fun. But is there like that kind of more, you know, clever mini game in Mario Party, or is it still just jump the rope?
They're all pretty general Mario Party mini games. Some of the boss battles are a little more involved, like, you might have to memorize certain patterns and the boss does something and you know, like this one I played this morning, it's like a memory game and like the cards come down and you sort of got to remember what colored platforms, like the boss moves to different colored platforms and, the different cards sort of represent what platforms are which. So you've got like, you know, 15 cards. You've got to sort of memorize the location of the different colors so you can select the right one.
Yeah, that does sound a little bit more involved than the, you know, some of the mini games that I've seen in past games.
The mini games I enjoy the most are generally like some of the more fast-paced ones, like the platforming ones and sort of, you know, the slot car type mini games. those sort of ones are in it again as well.
Yeah,
right.
There's a pretty fun Wii Bowling like knockoff. It's like you have a turtle shell, and there's a lines of Goombas that move along the laneway, and you got to try and hit as many as you can. So
nice.
And that's pretty much the same controls as Wii Bowling. You can also play that as a separate, like, longer form mini game, so you can do, like, 10 rounds.
10 rounds. Okay, so you can play it as a full bowling game.
Yeah, like, you can play it as, like, there's a few select mini games that, you, like, expanded upon. You can sort of play a more fully fleshed out, longer version of it. Like, there's a soccer game on there and a couple mm-hmm. of other ones. They've done that in, like, the past few Mario Party games. It's been, like, ice hockey and stuff like that.
Cool. All right. So what else have you been playing?
Earlier this week, I also downloaded the demo for Art of Balance Touch on the 3DS. I was looking through the eShop to try and decide what to download. Just decided to give the demo a go. It's pretty fun. The main objective is to place different shaped objects onto an area where there's like the playing field has sort of like different shaped hard surfaces like rocks and stuff that you got to try and balance all of the shapes that you have down on the bottom screen, and you got to like stack them up and try and make sure it can balance all of the different pieces without it falling over. So that was pretty fun. I ended up buying it this morning because there was a 29% discount on the price in PAL, Europe and Australia.
So they're still doing sales in some part of the world, at least.
Yeah, it was still $7.50 with the reduced price, but it's
but that's Australian dollars.
Yes, Australian dollars. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's worth it. I played like about half of World 1 this morning, so it gets pretty devious trying to balance the different shapes on all these irregular surfaces.
Mm.
Since this is made by Shinan, I assume that's the best-looking shape balancing game that you've ever seen.
Well, yeah, it's pretty impressive. It's full 3D on the top screen and everything. I've seen screenshots of like the WiiWare version, and it seems pretty much the same. I mean, how good does it need to look? Like,
yeah, very simple game. But I know Carl Castaneda, who we had on last week, is a big fan of the WiiWare version. Kind of randomly, I don't know how he got into it. I can't recall, but I know he's a big proponent of that one, and always wanted to try to get me to do it. I did play the demo. I thought it was okay, but not enough for me to pay the full price. And then this 3DS version that came out earlier this year has been getting really good reviews.
I think there's like extra content on top of whatever was in the WiiWare version and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
For a while, when I was playing the demo, I didn't realize you could rotate the shapes, so I was trying to balance everything without rotating the different blocks. So I was sort of fluked like the first three or four levels, but I was like, that can't be right because it just seems too hard and too hit or miss. Like it's. Then I was like, oh, you can rotate the shapes. That makes it easier.
Yeah, that's good. So I don't think there's a demo yet of this in North America. But
not that I know of.
Now that they've done it for Europe and Australia, hopefully we'll get that at some point.
We also got a demo for Style Boutique this morning.
Oh yeah,
as
we
well.
Got that today. Yeah. As well.
Style Savvy.
Yeah, I wasn't really holding my breath for that one, but I guess that'll make someone happy somewhere. So it's still good to have. But Art of Balance Touch is a game I would actually like to give the portable version a shot. It seems like probably a better fit for the portable. Format anyway. So I definitely would be interested in trying it again. I hope the demo will come out over here. All right. Well, thanks, Nick. That is going to wrap it up for new business. So we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we've got your listener mail and a lot of it. So stick around.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
This week, we have Impressions, Two Fast Fork Gnomes for 3DS by Aaron Kaluska. David the Gnome ain't no Commander Video, but that don't mean he can't run. Aaron has played this version of a runner game that originally debuted on the Wii.
We probably should have mentioned that James wrote the script for us before he ran off for sports.
We have impressions for Project X Zone by Danny Bibbins. Namco Bandai, Capcom, and Sega finally found a solution to their respective economic troubles. Crossovers. If you ever wanted a tactical RPG where you could partner Batsu Ishimoriji with Vashiron, could you please tell us who the hell those people are? Speaking of Japanese weirdness, we have a review of Liberation Maiden for 3DS by Tyler Olu. Tyler wrote Brain Mail to stand in for his review of an already weird game. It's a unique format.
Tyler wrote that review from the perspective of a character within the game.
Wow.
Yeah. So next up we have a blog called Halloween NES Grab Bag by Andy Gergen. Be haunted by this collection of NES spooktacular games. No. No more made up words and Halloween puns. Okay. Yeah, go read Andy's blog about Halloween-themed NES games. And we have an interview about Madden NFL with Yuri Bieloskurski by Jared Rosenberg and Josh Max. We ask Yuri about the Wii U version of everyone's favorite roster update to learn why the Wii U version is much more than that. And we have an interview for Aliens Colonial Marines with John Mulkey, and this one is by Ariel Rupp and Jared Rosenberg. Live, sorta, from Comic-Con, we talk with Gearbox's John Mulkey about the Wii U version of Aliens Colonial Marines. That is a hot game coming out early next year.
And we have a feature, Staff Says Number 10. Halloween game costumes we don't want at our doorsteps by the star. Need some nightmare fuel? How about a list of game characters that, in costume, would leave you emptying your bowels or seeking therapy?
Wow.
We also have a preview, Batman Arkham City Armored Edition by Patrick Barnett. Sure, the game is a year old, but there are a few new tools in the endless Bat Belt for the Wii U release of The Dark Knight's Dark Vault.
That is just a sampling of the great original content that we have on the site. By the time you hear this, we'll probably even have Guillaume's review of Too Fast for Gnomes. So if you haven't heard enough about it already on this podcast and want to learn more about that 3DS eShop game, you should go read that as well, along with lots of other stuff. And of course, the page that you care about above all else, the telethon page, is over at NintendoWorldReport.com. So go there, click on the big beautiful banner, and bookmark that for next Saturday. Welcome back to the show, everyone. It's time for listener mail. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. That is short for Radio Free Nintendo. These people know it, and the first email is going to be read by Guillaume.
The Darkest Red writes, my question pertains to the current status of the 3DS Virtual Console, particularly in North America. I picked up a 3DS at launch and I've been fairly happy with the system so far, Ambassador fiasco and all. That said, one of the 3DS's feature I was most excited for prior to launch was the Virtual Console. I had dreams of a system that would allow for robust digital collection of NES, SNES, Game Boy, and GBA games, and I was hoping Nintendo's experience with the Virtual Console on the Wii would help them achieve this goal. Now, over a year and a half since the system's launch, I am starting to wonder if we will ever see a healthy number of GBA classics, let alone SNES games of old. Sure, there are some great games available on the platform like Wario Land and Link's Awakening, but the trickle of the game-giving stream has been far too slow for my taste. How does the crew feel about Virtual Console on the 3DS so far? Do you have high hopes for the future? Do you think we will ever see a healthy offering of NES and SNES games on the system?
Who wants to go first here?
My hopes, personally, for the Virtual Console was mostly to see Game Boy gems that we hadn't seen before.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
We've seen, you know, a lot of Nintendo's biggest titles. What we haven't seen yet, at least in North America, is some of the biggest third-party titles. Mm-hmm. I will repeat that I really, really want the Final Fantasy Legend games to come out,
please,
for this thing.
Amen.
And if we have to wait 3-4 years, like we had to wait 3-4 years on the Virtual Console, I think that's way too late. I'm not too distraught by the fact that we don't see SNES games on there, because if the NES games are any indication, they would just be repeats of games we've already on the Wii Virtual Console.
Right. Yeah. I never really felt that. I mean, at first we didn't even know that we were going to get console games on this platform for Virtual Console.
Right.
Or Virtual Handheld, as we used to call it.
What were the initial platforms that they said would be on this thing? There was Game Boy, Game Gear, and actually Game Boy, like the
Game Boy Color.
Yeah, and also wasn't the portable Turbo Duo or whatever it is also mentioned?
I don't know. That hasn't happened though, has it?
No. And Game Gear has barely happened.
Yeah.
It happened, then it stopped.
Yeah, there were like three games that came out at the beginning, and I think there was one other week since then where they released a couple more.
We have like two Sonic games on Game Gear, I think.
I think that they are raring to... Like, I think Japan just got Sonic 2 for the Game Gear on their virtual console. So it's taking a lot of time.
I don't really think Game Gear was ever a great platform. You know, I don't really care about the Game Gear library.
Right.
But there were lots of great games for Game Boy and Game Boy Color and Game Boy Advance. And I think there's a few things that have caused this. But I do agree with you, Guillaume, that I never really expected them to start releasing NES or Super Nintendo games on 3DS Virtual Console that aren't already on Wii. And, you know, you can make an argument that, hey, if they ever brought out, you know, let's say Chrono Trigger or Final Fantasy VI or something like that, that is already out on the Wii Virtual Console, but having it portable would be nice. And some people would rebuy it, or some people would consider buying it for 3DS, even if they didn't get it on the Wii Virtual Console. But to me, that's not all that exciting of a proposition. I mean, these games are already pretty easy to get, and I'm a lot more excited about some of the handheld games that were that I completely missed because I never had the system when I was a kid, or because they were really rare. You know, I think there's a lot of GBA, Game Boy Color type things that are pretty hard to find that would be wonderful to have on a digital platform like this. And then just games that aren't available on any other platform. And I think that's kind of, you know, it's like, it's hard for me to get excited about The Legend of Zelda being on 3DS eShop because I've played that, many times on many different systems. So I don't really care that it's out on 3DS also. But I think that's also the reason that it is on 3DS is because they've already emulated this on a lot of different platforms. And it's a game that Nintendo understands very well. They know how to test it to make sure that it's working properly. And they know the ins and outs of the code in such a way that they can emulate it and make it work on a lot of different platforms. And I think that's the reason you've seen a tendency to favor games like that rather than a lot of these Game Boy games that they've never emulated before that are a lot harder to test.
Mm-hmm. And I gotta say, I'm not a big fan of the idea of paying again to download some of these games that I already paid for. I know they're different systems. I know there's work involved in getting them to work on a different console. But then I am kind of used to the PlayStation way of doing things where your PlayStation 1 classics don't work on two systems. So,
but I, nominally, they work on multiple systems.
Yeah,
without you having to pay extra. Yeah, there's a lot to be said for that, and I think, you know, I think Nintendo could learn something from that model, and they might say, well, if we can get people to pay for this twice, we're gonna, you know, and I can't begrudge them that really. I think it'd be better for the consumer if I think it would promote sales. Frankly, I think that's the reason Sony does it, and I think it would be smart for Nintendo to say, if you buy this game, we're going to let you play it on every platform that we can. And that will give people more confidence and they will buy more games that way. Whereas if you make it so that, you know, you release all these different platforms and you ask people to rebuy the game on every platform that comes out, I think you're actually kind of discouraging people from buying games at all because they feel like they're getting nickeled and dimed, you know, or that they're going to buy it on the wrong platform, and then they'll regret it, and they'll say, well, I wish I had it on the portable, but I already paid for it on the Wii, and I really don't want to, you know, and so that just turns them off from the whole idea of buying these things in the first place.
Yeah. I sort of, I don't really like the fact that they're bringing over console games to the handheld service. I would rather stay separate, like the virtual console and the Wii U is console only, and the handheld one is handheld only. Game Boy stuff be the priority. Like, there's tons of games that they could release. You know, it'd be interesting to see if they ever release Pokemon Red and Blue, and sort of enhance it for the trading aspect or something.
They won't enhance it, but they will release those eventually.
Yeah.
But those are very, very late Game Boy games, and they're a lot harder to test because they're long and they're very complicated. So those games will come out eventually because there's a fortune to be made by selling those yet again. I mean, a lot of Pokemon fans already have bought that game 5 or 6 times in various versions. But releasing them digitally and letting them always live on your 3DS no matter where you go is appealing to a lot of people. And Nintendo will do that because there's too much money to be made. But it's going to take longer because of the complexity of those games. Yeah,
but I think to release those games, they would have to look into allowing trading and stuff. Otherwise, you can't really finish it.
Depends on what you mean by finishing.
Yeah.
You can beat the game without trading. I mean, that is a big part of the appeal, and I would be impressed if they went that extra mile. But to me, the more likely scenario, the Nintendo way of doing things is to say, well, certain features will not be supported in the Virtual Console version, and that's the trade-off you make for downloading this classic game for the low, low price of $4.99.
I think that recently the SRB has announced that for downloadable games, it was waiving the fees for getting games rated.
Really?
Yeah. So that is a pretty big deal. I think they were feeling iOS breathing down their necks, and they were like, oh, we still want to be relevant. And so they decided to waive the fees for downloadable games, which is huge. I mean, I don't know if it's going to make an incredible difference on the eShop, but it certainly won't hurt.
You know, it's not going to make a big difference for like new eShop games, but for Virtual Console, I think it does because, you know, we've heard in the past in various interviews and we've talked about on the show before, but the cost to get a game rated by the ESRB is on the order of tens of thousands of dollars, whether it's a brand new game or whether you're just porting or emulating a classic game and selling it. And a lot of these games had never been rated before, you know, because they were released before ESRB existed. And so they had to be rated from scratch, which is a long process. And it requires a lot of work from the people who are publishing it. And, it makes the process longer. And so there ends up being a kind of high fixed cost for releasing these games. And the ESRB was a large part of that. So it's not just the bandwidth that you sell every time you, it's not just the bandwidth you pay for every time you sell a copy of it. Which is very, very cheap, but there's a high fixed cost. And if you go through all this trouble and you spend lots of money to get this game rated and finally get it published, and you only sell 1,000 copies of it because it's really obscure and it's kind of this kind of niche cult favorite game that not that many people know about. And then on top of that, Nintendo takes a 30% cut, you know, as a third party, it makes it very hard to justify releasing some of these lesser known games. Even though there is a vocal minority of people who would really, really like to have it on that service. So if you can cut out those fixed costs, I think it changes that equation a lot.
Yep. I think that Victoria Ireland did a little jig that day.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, he should. Victor Ireland was never all that involved with Game Boy stuff, but for other download platforms, you know, he does a lot of stuff for PSN. Releasing old PS1 and PS2 games.
Apparently, like, he came very close to making deals with, who is it, Hudson, to get the Batman game released, the NES Batman game.
Oh, my God. Oh, yeah. Wow.
Apparently,
that's a good game.
They were basically at the finish line, and then something happened, management changed, I don't know, and then they were like, okay, thanks for all the work, and goodbye.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, if he could do that, he could do Gimmick. He could do a bunch of like really cool Japanese stuff that never came out because he can handle the localization, and that's very simple for those games anyway.
Yeah.
You know, he was involved in bringing Blaster Master out on Virtual Console, which I bought. I was very happy to buy that and play through that again.
Yeah.
Guys like that, Victor Ireland is a guy who probably doesn't have a lot of resources. He doesn't have this huge bank account he can use to pull out these dream projects and publish these games. But if you bring that scale down so that, you know, he can make some money, even if he sells only a few copies, then he turns into like the digital Atlas or the digital Xseed. You know, they're releasing these games and they know they're only going to sell a few thousand copies, but they've set up their business model so that that's sustainable.
Right.
And these people who want them can get these really cool games that they would never get otherwise. That's exciting for me.
Yeah. And while we kind of brush aside the idea of SNES games on the 3DS, I mean, if there were, you know, mostly niche games coming out in the future for both the Wii and the 3DS virtual consoles at the same time, I would probably pick the 3DS one. Because it's just so much easier to get into and to, you know, just start playing an old school game anywhere you are.
It's true, but we still don't really know how Virtual Console is going to work on Wii U. I mean, we know that, you know, this has come up before, but we know that you can play your existing Wii Virtual Console games in Wii mode on the Wii U.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't know, are they going to start releasing Virtual Console games in a way that is natively played on the Wii U? Will there be more advanced games? Will there be GameCube titles, for instance, that you could download and play in Wii U mode?
Mm.
And then maybe you can play those on the screen because they're technically Wii U games.
Yeah, yeah.
And if that's the case, then is Nintendo going to start pulling all of those Wii Virtual Console games into the Wii U library and making them compatible so that you can sort of buy everything from one store? Because otherwise it's going to get kind of complicated, you know? It's like, well, this is a Wii Virtual Console game, but this is a Wii U Virtual Console game. You know, and it's like it gets very confusing. So to me, it makes sense to merge those and to keep them consistent.
Well, I would assume that they're probably going to handle it the same way that they've been handling the Ambassador games that have been slowly been made available for purchase.
Mm.
They get some new features, some new instruction manuals,
mm-hmm.
and new icon.
You get an upgrade once it becomes available.
Yeah, I think so.
On the new platform.
But the whole Wii U thing, I don't think would affect my purchase decisions. They still wouldn't be portable, and I think it's the portability that really appeals to me. Especially for old school RPGs, I really wish that I could have been playing Final Fantasy V on my PSP, but I'm probably gonna have to dust out the old PS2 and try to play it with, you know, from the disc. And that's much less appealing.
Well, this is where you and I differ a bit. And maybe it's because, you know, I grew up playing those games. I mean, your first RPG was a Game Boy game.
Yeah.
So for you, those games go hand in hand with playing on a portable system. I grew up playing them on consoles and on PC. So I really want to sit down and sink back into my couch and play on the big screen. And so, if some awesome, obscure Super Nintendo RPG is released on Virtual Console because of this ESRB change, for instance, I am probably more likely to buy it on the Wii U than I am on the 3DS. So it depends on the kind of game. But obviously, look, I just hooked up my Game Boy Player to play Final Fantasy V, so obviously there's some appeal to me in playing on the TV.
Right.
And, what does excite me is, you know, because of this change, if this has a chance to revitalize Virtual Console a little bit and get more publisher interest, more third-party especially interest, for me it is exciting for these platforms that have been sort of stagnant, like Super Nintendo on the Wii Virtual Console. You know, it's come to a point where it feels like there probably aren't many Super Nintendo games coming out ever on Virtual Console now. They've kind of done all the ones that they think are worth doing. And if there's a chance to revitalize that and to open that spigot back up and bring out more games and get increasingly into the corners of gaming that most of the Virtual Console releases, you know, were fairly mainstream, fairly well-known popular games. So if we can kind of get out into the boundaries a little bit more, that's exciting for me.
Mm-hmm.
Amen. I'm right there with you.
Okay. The next email comes from Dan, and he writes, I recently started my own video game podcast. And while we cover all systems and even tabletop games, I'm obviously the huge Nintendo guy on the show. I recently started to get a lot of Facebook comments from a listener accusing me of being a fanboy and generally unleashing all the negative stereotypes people have slung at the Big N for years. It's for kids. It's not next gen. Nintendo is all about gimmicks, etc. My question is, what can Nintendo do to ever escape these silly comments, if anything? And do you all, as Nintendo fans, ever still come in contact with these stereotypes? How do you handle it gracefully? Thanks so much, and keep up the amazing work. I was 100% inspired to start my show because of your terrific work. Wow, thanks. That's awesome.
Well, I did some research on this. And
it's called The First 20 Years of My Life.
No, I was going to say, I believe that the phenomenon that you're in contact with, I think that you are being quote-unquote trolled.
Mm.
And I think that you can ignore people on Facebook, right?
Mm-hmm. You can block
so
them.
That would be how the way to handle it gracefully, because it doesn't sound like this guy would probably change his mind. Like, I don't think he's there to listen to your arguments as to why, you know, Nintendo doesn't suck. I don't think that's really what he's interested in. So I think that the only way that you could really deal with that is to continue to express your passion for Nintendo on your podcast while, you know, blocking this asshole on Facebook.
I think, just responding to people on Facebook like that would just probably result in flame wars eventually. It would escalate, and, you know, it sounds like the sort of person that probably won't take on board what you're saying and stuff. I think the main thing would probably be to think about would be on the podcast, I guess I'm guessing that you would do this already, but just saying something's good isn't enough. You'd have to sort of go into a bit more in depth, sort of explain your reasoning, I guess.
Yeah.
Something like that.
And, you know, it helps if you play things other than Nintendo, because number one, I think it gives you a little bit more validity to in people's minds, because they see that you're not just a Nintendo fan, you know, that you're not close-minded, but that you can appreciate Nintendo even within a larger context. And, you know, I tend to think this is part of why I like our show, because I think we try – one thing I try to do is I try to give Nintendo fans a good name. You know, I think Nintendo fans have a reputation of being sort of insular. And this is these comments that you get from people, these sort of belittling insults, are part of the reason that sites like ours exist. This is why there are specialty Nintendo forums and websites and podcasts, because a lot of people feel like their interest in Nintendo, even if it's not an exclusive interest, you know, but if you like Pokemon and you like Halo, a lot of people feel like those two things are incompatible. And they will make fun of you. And so I think people flee those environments and they look for a place that is more accepting and where they can feel more comfortable talking about the things that they do like, particularly Nintendo. And so, you know, this has worked out very well to our benefit over the past 12 or 13 years of doing the website. But I think it's too bad. And one thing that that I've championed for a very long time doing this podcast and this website is that I want people to feel that it's totally cool to prefer Nintendo and to be really, really interested in Nintendo. But I also want to expose people to the idea that there is more out there than just Nintendo stuff, and that you can look through all of gaming from the lens of being a Nintendo fan. You know, I grew up with Nintendo. I still play more Nintendo than anything else. But I play other things too, and my love for Nintendo and understanding of what they do informs how I react to all this other kind of stuff in video gaming. And I think that's a very worthwhile perspective, of course. I mean, it's my perspective. I think that's a perspective of a lot of people who listen to this show. And I think that is a perspective that doesn't get out there much. I think a lot of people don't realize that such people exist. and that's why I loved, I always loved hearing Billy go on Weekend Confirmed, for instance, because if you listen to that show, you know that that Billy's a huge Nintendo fan. Even if you've never been to our website, if you don't know what he did before, you know, before now, you would get very quickly that he is a huge Nintendo fan, but he'll also go on there and talk about Call of Duty and this other stuff. And I think he's a great ambassador for our kind, you know, because he goes out there and he lets other people know that there are people who love Nintendo and they're not crazy. They're not fixated on Nintendo. It's not the only kind of game that they will allow themselves to play. They're gamers just like everybody else, and everyone has their own biases and their own preferences. It's a very rich spectrum. And I think it's good to show people that Nintendo fans have a broader worldview, and understand that Nintendo's not perfect and not everything they put out is the greatest thing ever, but also are very willing to give them a fair shake.
Online, I've met people who I was trying to convince that, for instance, the Radio for Nintendo or Negative World podcasts were good podcasts, even though they were focused on Nintendo. And they were like, you know, I don't really see the point of listening to that kind of biased perspective. And, you know, like I try to get it through their heads that, well, yes, there is a bias, but we're not closed-minded. Like we just discuss video games in general, but from the perspective of a Nintendo fan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it was really hard to make them understand that it wasn't really about anything related to any console war or anything like that.
Bias is the wrong word. It's a critical perspective. Bias implies that you take whatever inputs are out there and you twist them in order to fit your narrative and to make your points for you. No matter what the reality is, you distort that in such a way that your message marches forward undeterred. And that's not what we do. What we do is a critical perspective. It's kind of a classical thing. It's like, you know, you're reviewing this book and your personal perspective, whatever that may be, maybe you're a feminist or maybe you're an academic or whatever. I mean, there's a rich tradition of this going back hundreds of years, and it's not that unusual. It's the idea that by looking at a subject through someone else's point of view, you learn about a different side of it that you hadn't experienced before. And that's why it's important to listen to people who you don't always agree with.
Mm. Yeah.
It makes you more intelligent.
And if you listen to a lot of gaming podcasts, a lot of them are more oriented towards PS3 and 360 games.
And I find that valuable.
Yeah.
Because that's not where I come from.
But also, like, those podcasts usually have people that are just plain ignorant about what Nintendo is doing, mm-hmm. or the various Nintendo games that that are out there. Like, they've never even heard of. They certainly haven't played them for themselves. And so, I think it's important to, you know, have that perspective out there. And, I don't know, like, I haven't witnessed these fights on Facebook that you have been having. But perhaps, you know, try to explain that to your troll, and if that doesn't work, I would just say ignore it.
Yeah, there's a difference between listening to other people's points of view and having informed discussion with people who you don't necessarily agree with. Those are healthy things.
Mm-hmm.
When someone's trolling you, their ears are closed. They're trying to get a reaction out of you. They're not trying to start a conversation. And I think those people, I don't think you should try to force a conversation on them because you're only really playing into their hands. I think you should block that person. Luckily, on the internet, it's a lot easier to ignore them than in real life. I bet all three of us have, at some point in our lives, run into people who, even maybe to our faces, made fun of us for liking the games that we like.
Yeah, back in, like, early high school, one of my friends now, like when I first met him, he was a big sort of, you know, PlayStation gamer. But yeah, like, I just sort of started speaking to him. He's like, well, play Zelda Ocarina of Time and come back to me when you're done. Like, just sort of, you know, just through speaking to him, I was able to sort of turn the tide. And, you know, he was a GameCube fan after that until, you know, he didn't buy a PS2 until, what, 2005 or something? Like, if you give people, like, you sort of feel out the person and give them good suggestions to go and try out, you might, you know, be able to sort of, they might become more open to playing other Nintendo games.
Yeah, and, like, it's funny because before I met my girlfriend, she had seen on my Facebook page that I had a video game podcast, so she had looked it up. And I was, you know, I was really like, holy crap, what have I done, when I realized that she had done that, you know, like
she was going to find out eventually, Guillaume.
Yeah, I guess. But, you know, it turned out great. And just because now I play games with her.
Just be thankful she didn't listen to it on like a Choaniki episode.
But yeah, like the from her and from other friends of mine, I've gotten the comments like, you know, like when you say you're into video games, like I you know, like you're different from the image I had in my mind. Like, how come you're not playing Call of Duty? Like, how come you're not always talking about headshots? And actually, no, but seriously, I've actually, they probably don't know what headshots are. But anyway, I've had some really interesting conversations with people who don't usually play video games. And, you know, like I've talked to them about, like, one of them has gotten recently into iOS games. And he asked me, like, how come, you know, you're not really into those games? And how come you like Nintendo games so much? And I, you know, we had a really good conversation about game design.
People like us that sort of are more involved with talking about games and stuff sort of sometimes get hung up on the fact that they think that the outside, like normal people, like just general people, won't think it's cool, or they won't be interested in games. But like my girlfriend, when I met her, she didn't really play games, like, but she had a DS sort of stashed away in a closet and had stuff like, you know, the Golden Compass and things like that. So,
oh boy,
you know, like all these licensed games. And I've sort of started slowly like talking to her about it more, and sort of nudged her in the direction of stuff like Animal Crossing and stuff. And now, you know, she's buying Sonic All-Stars Racing for the Wii U when it comes out. Like, you know, people are open to video games. It's not like it was back in the, you know, early 90s and stuff, where this stuff wasn't accessible to sort of the mainstream.
It's true. Yeah, it's true. A lot of times when I meet new people, whether it's a girl I'm trying to chat up, or, you know, it's just someone who I, you know, just getting to know, and they don't know much about me. And, you know, sometimes we, you know, the conversation will start to veer towards what I do in my free time. And I'm always a little bit nervous to get into it, 'cause I'm like, this, I always feel it's, it, I think it, it, I think it sounds ridiculous when I say out loud that, for instance, I spend a lot of time every week on, you know, doing a Nintendo podcast. And if you haven't heard the show, you might think that sounds really silly.
Johnny, you just need to say you're a media personality.
yeah, I'm an ombudsman. No, but you know, usually what I try to pivot it to in order to give them a better appreciation for it is, look, I've been doing this for a long time. We have a lot of people who listen. We get into some pretty deep esoteric topics, and ultimately, what it comes down to is, I get together with two or three of my friends every week, and we get to talk. We get to have really in-depth, detailed, fun, enthusiastic conversations about something that we have in common. And it's, in that sense, it's not that much different than going out with your buddies to go watch a soccer game at a bar. You know, it's really not that much different. It's just a different topic. And I think then what people will focus on is, so you really know a lot about this stuff. They'll start asking you questions, or they won't care what the topic is, and they'll be more interested in just the format. You know, oh wow, that's really cool. How do you do it? How do you put it together? How do you get it out to people? And you know, this is a very specific to us doing a podcast, but I think there's a lot of ways you can work this in. You know, whatever role gaming plays in your life, whether it's just to release some steam, or to give you something to do with your kid, or your partner, whatever it is, I think there's certainly nothing to be ashamed about in gaming, and not Nintendo gaming either. So I think it speaks to a larger issue of if you feel defensive about being a Nintendo fan, it's probably related to being defensive about playing video games, period. And I certainly appreciate feeling that way, because I do sometimes too, but you don't have to. It's really unnecessary. And, you know, I would say just practice talking to people about it. You don't have to record the conversation like we do, but practice talking to your friends and your family and people you meet about video games, and why you like them. And I think you'll find out pretty quickly that it's not that hard to explain why you like them, or why you like Nintendo specifically.
My dad actually used to, when I we've got a 64 and stuff. Like, we used to have a Sega Mega Drive back in the day, so he used to sort of poke fun at me, saying, like, oh, that Nintendo, you know, Nintendo's for kiddies sort of thing, why you keep, you know? Like, I was like, no, Zelda's good.
Yeah.
You know, like, then I ended up playing GoldenEye with him later, but, like, you know, it's sort of funny.
GoldenEye will change your mind pretty quickly about the nature of Nintendo and the people who play Nintendo systems. Mm.
And as for the part of the question that asks if what can Nintendo do to change this image that they have, like, do we think that they have to do anything? I mean, we kind of saw the effect of that image had on people when they announced that they were publishing Bayonetta. the trolls certainly did come out of the woodwork when that got announced. Sure. And they were, you know, some people were just couldn't comprehend that Nintendo had stolen this franchise from them. Like, they could not understand that Nintendo, of all companies, would be interested in publishing that game. And they I think some of them actually thought they were doing it out of spite, you know, or it was a trick.
They think Nintendo is going to pervert it into being less mature or less crazy or less sexualized than the first game. And
we know that's not the case, because right. We know that they had the GameCube had the only version of BMX XX that wasn't censored. Whether that's a good thing or not, I don't know.
And it had the best version of Resident Evil 4. You can always come up with counterexamples, but no amount of counterexamples will change a deeply ingrained perception that people have about Nintendo in general. And that's because a lot of people grew up with Nintendo, and because it's not that Nintendo primarily focuses on younger gamers, but Nintendo caters to younger gamers along with older gamers in a way that most other companies don't. A lot of other companies completely ignore younger gamers. They're not interested in them whatsoever. Or when they cater to them, they do it in a really crass, commercial way. You know, like making games based on the Golden Compass, which is a great book and not a great movie and a terrible video game. So, you know, and that gives people a bad perception about games made for children. And I think Nintendo mm-hmm. does make games for children that are wonderful and can be enjoyed by other people, but it's not that that's all that they do, but they do it in a vacuum of other people doing it. And so they have a certain reputation. That's their specialty. And I think that's okay. I think Nintendo should not do anything to try to change that perception, because in anything that they did to try to make themselves come across as being more mature is only going to backfire. No good will come of it. You can look through history and see that has always been the case. And it's too much of a cultural identity that they have that to just overturn it with one or two games, you know, unless you're going to come out with this huge new brand or, you know, the black label games or something like that we've talked about before. But even that, I think, has a low chance of success.
Mm. Yep. I would have found E3 very boring if Nintendo had as many boobs and, you know, as much blood as the other conferences did.
Yeah. Exactly.
Nintendo Land has a secret room you can go to. It's like a special room with an X marked on it.
It's the Bayonetta room, actually. All right, so Nick is going to read the next email.
Okay, Paul from Central Coast, Australia writes, in an age where patches, updates, and design revisions are a dime a dozen, it's recently occurred to me that I might be in the minority in preferring the designer's original intent. Some examples. Sucker Punch changed the design of Infamous 2 main character after fan outcry, and Criterion, after saying they wouldn't, added a restart option in Burnout Paradise, citing that they intended the players to freely roam the city rather than get fixated on a single race. Being a huge fan of Tim Schafer's work, I contributed to the Double Fine Kickstarter, but haven't participated in the forums where game concepts have been shared for fan feedback. The entire reason I chipped in is because I trust Schafer and expect a game from him and his team on their terms, not to the whims of the fans. Nintendo and their teams are one of the few I can think of who stick to their guns, for better or worse. Skyward Sword is bloated, sure, but I'd definitely prefer that singular vision over what Capcom tried with Mega Man Legends 3 and throw it to the insane Zelda fanbase. What are your thoughts on this issue?
Are we talking about auteur theory here?
A little bit.
I don't think that there are a lot of video games outside of indie games, really indie games, that, you know, really are auteur games. The example with Sucker Punch, I mean, yeah, they changed the design of the main character, but they probably changed it based on some focus group who, you know, they probably got data that said, well, our character doesn't look extreme enough. We got to make him more extreme.
Yeah, I mean, that Infamous is a terrible example for this argument, because that character was probably focus grouped to all hell in the first place, and then a different focus group told them to change it, and then the ultimate focus group, called the Internet, told them to change it back to what it was in the first place.
Yeah,
I don't think there was a whole lot of creative, artistic principle that went into any of that process. And you could say that for Criterion's, you know, Burnout Paradise as well. So, I think you're right, Guillaume. Video games are almost by definition created by teams of people. Mm-hmm. It is very rare for a single person to create a video game from scratch and have total creative control. And,
yeah, and even if they are in a position where they should have a lot of say over, you know, the overall product. Mm-hmm. I mean, recently, I saw a tweet. What's his name? Cliff Bizinski, you know, tweeted at Capcom in general, like, hey, if you're wondering what to do with RE, Resident Evil, you know, give me a call. And so, like,
is great, because Gears of War, he co-created Gears of War, which is very, very heavily influenced by Resident Evil 4.
Yeah.
So it'd be pretty cool to see him go back and get to work on the series that influenced him so much.
Yeah, but also, like, I think that some fans were like, well, you know, what are your problems with the current one, with Resident Evil 6? And I think he probably mentioned something about QTEs. And some fans replied back, well, don't you have QTEs in your games, in Gears of War? And he said, yeah, but, you know, I was design director, not design dictator.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if he really has a distaste for that kind of thing, which were present in his games, like, that really goes to show that, you know, like, the guy who looks like he might have the final say on things doesn't really have it all the time.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, I think auteur theory is, you know, it comes mostly from film criticism. It's the idea that even though this big team of people have to work together in order to make a movie happen, there's sometimes there is one person at the top who does have this sort of total creative control and make sure that the final product is entirely from his or her mind. And I think that has almost never happened in reality. I think it's an interesting idea, and it's all in grades, right? I mean, it's all relative. There are people on the team who have more creative control than other people, and their vision will come through more. But I think, you know, in movies as well as in video games, the best scenario is when you have someone at the top who has a really strong, clear idea that's a good idea, and they have the willpower to actually carry it all the way through, but they're willing to listen to good ideas from people they trust. And that's what makes a good team. You have someone who has big ideas and has the personality to really bring those together and not have them be diluted through focus groups or just from having too many producers and too many people putting their ideas in and trying too many things and never saying no to anyone. You need someone who has the authority and the will to say, no, that's a bad idea. That is not as good as my idea. And we're going to stick with my idea. You have to have that, but they have to have someone to say no to. And if you didn't have a team of people, and if you didn't have other people providing input, whether those are internal to the team, whether they're fans, I think there's just a certain healthy amount of that, and you can go over it, and then the game becomes really generic and mediocre or just messy and chaotic. But there's a healthy amount of feedback from other people that gives that person who has a really great creative idea something to bounce off of, and gives them a reality check sometimes, and gives them a little bit more perspective. And if you didn't have that, if you really had an auteur who had complete 100% creative control, they would make the same thing over and over again.
they wouldn't make the Star Wars prequels.
No.
Where I sort of I agree with like this sort of line of thinking is where when the game comes out and the developers retroactively go back and change major elements, that would be bad. Just bowing to like the fan pressure, like, you know, we can go and talk about Mass Effect 3. Like that sort of happened with that. I don't play the Mass Effect game, so I don't really have the perspective on if it was a good or a bad thing. But I think having BioWare sort of concede defeat to the whims of the general public, I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that still.
They didn't concede defeat to the extent that you probably think they did.
No, I haven't. Like I said, I haven't played it, but
it was sort of like, it was sort of like the dogs are barking outside and you can't get to sleep, so you throw them a piece of white bread. It shuts them up, but it's not really nutritious, and it's not really what they wanted, but it gets the job done. That's kind of how I feel about the Mass Effect extended ending. Mm. It doesn't really address the concerns that people had, which I think is good, because I think they should stick with their guns, and I think the ending they had in the first place was fine. But it was a goodwill gesture, and it shut people up for the
most
part.
So do they just present the ending in a different way?
Yeah, it's the same content. It's just it's slightly more detail,
right?
Basically.
Okay.
Yeah, but they didn't fundamentally change it, and they shouldn't. You know, and I think, you know, the idea that patches, you know, pervert the creator's original intent is almost never true. Patches usually to fix something that should have been fixed before the game came out. So that's really a whole other thing. But, you know, Zelda is, we should talk about Zelda, because Zelda is a series that a lot of people feel has stagnated a little bit, or it's just a little bit backwards in thinking on certain aspects. You know, very innovative in certain ways, from game to game, but in certain ways a little too beholden to tradition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's one person. I don't think it's Miyamoto who is causing that. I don't think it's Aonuma. I think rather it's the fact that the same core group of people, and it's probably about 10 to 20 people, have been making Zelda games for over a decade, and they make all the Zelda games since Minish Cap at least. Mm-hmm. And they make them over and over again, and they finish a Zelda game and they start working on the next Zelda game. And I don't know that there's a lot of opportunity for that bubble to get new ideas pushed into it. I think they're creative people, and there are creative ideas that come out of that series that come from within, probably. But these certain things that annoy us, or things that we think were okay at one point, but we've kind of seen it one too many times, you know, I think those messages don't necessarily get to that team, because they've been insulated so much by Nintendo.
Yeah, I agree with that. Like, I would be happier if a completely different team took Zelda and did whatever, like, you know, just to get some fresh blood in there. Like, I think that's one of the problems with the series is it's the same people, core people, making Zelda after Zelda. And sometimes I think they just can't see it. Like, they're like, and also the younger staff are probably too afraid to try and rock the boat too much. They're too afraid to speak up and say, you know, like, we should probably do this differently. Like,
that might be part of Japanese culture as well.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder. I get that, sometimes. But
yeah, because you feel like the people who created most of Nintendo's franchises were starting from scratch. Like, they didn't have to convince someone to change their ways in order to get a good idea in. They just did it.
Yeah, because they were inventing the way to do it, basically.
Right. And that hasn't happened as much in the past 10 or 20, maybe 10 or 15 years, because a lot of people at Nintendo, I'd say most of the people who develop games within Nintendo, are working on established franchises. Mm. So there is an established way to do it, and they're there to learn how to do it like the guys before them did it, to become the masters. They're sort of in training. They're like apprentices, you know. I want to learn the skill to make a Zelda game. Or, they talked about this specifically with Mario, with New Super Mario Bros. 2, and they send people off to the school where this like tutorial where they learn to design Mario levels. And it's like, well, that's great. I mean, that's a really interesting proprietary skill that Nintendo has that most other companies don't have. And I think it's great that they're teaching their younger employees how to do that. But are they also teaching their younger employees how to do things that have never been done before in a Mario level that are fun in new and interesting ways that will excite the players? Based on NSMB2, it seems not.
Gold.
I think on Twitter I remarked that probably one of the first lessons that they all learned was that once you are at the bus door and there's the wall, you have to put a hidden block next to the wall so right. that, you know, hiding a power-up. Like, it, almost every freaking tower or castle in New Super Mario Bros. 2 had that. And, yeah, you can see that they were all, you know, following the same class. You know, they were all listening to the same teacher. Yeah. And they all ended up kind of doing the same thing.
Yeah. Another thing, I think, though, is that I think Nintendo as a company, like the higher-ups and stuff, they're sort of scared. They don't want the games to fail, obviously, but I think they should start taking more risks on doing stuff that may not immediately pay off, like Metroid Other M, for instance. Like, that did new stuff, but, you know, it wasn't received that well overall, but it was at least doing something new and different. Like, they could look at that and fix that idea up later. Like, if they did something crazy with Zelda, if some of it works, some of it doesn't, that's fine. Like, the first Legend of Zelda had its fair share of problems as well.
Majora's Mask was like the greatest risk they've ever taken with that series, and I think they learned a lot from that game. They learned what to do and they learned what not to do. But if you don't take risks, then you end up sort of making the same thing over and over again. You never learn lessons, you know.
Mm.
The only lesson that Nintendo seems to have learned about 2D Mario games in the past 5 or 6 years is that we should keep making them because they sell a lot. But they haven't really taken very many risks with it, and so I don't think they've really had any failures, and they haven't really learned anything. We'll see. The Wii U game does look quite interesting. So maybe I'm speaking too soon here, but I do wonder a little bit, you know. It's not necessarily that I think these classic franchises that we want to continue. I mean, I want more Zelda and more Mario and more Metroid games. It's not that I necessarily think Nintendo should give those over to completely different development teams.
No.
But I think they should maybe consider bringing in some new people, some fresh blood, and giving them the authority and the trust to really make an impact on the team and do something different and go with that and be willing to experiment a little bit more. And that has a lot to do with their internal culture, and it's just something that we don't have very much insight into, and we certainly don't have any influence over it. So we'll just have to see if it happens over time.
I think, you know, with sort of the announcements that Miyamoto is moving away to his own sort of, you know, little development studio or whatever he's going to do, is going to be much better. Like, I think over the past decade, with Miyamoto sort of seeing over, like, looking over everything at Nintendo, it's sort of brought it together.
Yeah,
like,
everything's become Miyamoto.
It's put a layer of Miyamoto across everything, and the different teams have lost their unique voice, sort of thing. Like,
right. And also, so in some cases, that Miyamoto effect is not as potent as it was when he was actually directing games and doing it personally.
Yeah, and like, he does have a positive impact on things like Skyward Sword, where the team didn't really know how to make the sword fighting work, so they were already kind of giving up with motion controls and were planning to have regular combat, like just button presses or whatever. And Miyamoto was the one pushing them, like, you know, probably like dropped a disc of Wii Sports Resort at their doorstep so that they would see how it's done. But basically,
because I had no idea about it beforehand.
What is this?
If you read the Iwata asks, that's basically what they say. They're like, wait, what? Like, this other team has been working on these problems and they found solutions? What are you talking about?
That's a little oversimplified, but I do think the DNA of Wii Sports Resort is maybe a little too obvious in Skyward Sword.
Yeah.
when you're bowling bombs and stuff like that, it's like, really? But anyway, that's going to have to wrap up the show. What a bunch of great emails we had this week. Thanks, everybody, for writing in. Again, the email address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and you can head over to the show notes for this episode and click on the link there as well. And before we go, I want to make one last big push for the telethon, because this is the last episode you're going to hear before that event happens. We're not recording. Yeah, I know. It's coming up really soon now. So we're about a week away by when this episode comes out. And if you don't listen to it right away, we're considerably less than a week away. So I hope you've been bookmarking it. I hope you're following us on Facebook and Twitter and checking the website, because that is the most up-to-date way to learn about the event. But it is a live event, and I really think you should be there live, because that is the most fun way. We're going to have lots of prizes and ways to interact with the staff and with our special guests. And you miss out on that if you're not there live. And the donation, the feedback loop of people donating and that keeping us on the air longer and doing more content, that really requires the live experience. You can always listen to the recording afterward, and you can always donate afterwards. We'll keep it open for a couple of weeks after the telethon just to get some stragglers. But at that point, it's all over but the shouting. At that point, you can't really affect the outcome anymore. You can still donate to a great charity, but you've missed out on a lot of the fun, which is putting that money in and knowing that it's driving us to do more crazy, stupid things on the internet, which is what the telethon is all about. If someone tells you that talking about Nintendo for 9 hours straight is not crazy, then you should have them examined. So before we go, I did want to just to hype things up a little bit in case you haven't been following on Twitter and Facebook every day as we make these announcements. I just wanted to go into some of the awesome stuff coming up on the telethon that you might not know about. So we're going to jump back on the Wii U hype train. We're going to get Mr. Lindemann in there, and we're going to the telethon is only a week before the launch, so it's really close, and we're going to have yet another kind of different perspective on things at that point. So we're going to be talking about that. I think we're going to revisit our game of the decade, Metroid Prime, because the telethon is happening pretty close to the 10-year anniversary of the release of Metroid Prime. It is an endlessly fascinating game, in my opinion. Certainly one of the most important games Nintendo has released in the past 10 years, and I think it's very much worth going back to that. We might bring in some new voices who you haven't heard before talk about that game, and it's going to be a lot of fun. And we want to hear what you think about it as well, of course. For the first time ever, we're doing a Eurocast. We're going to have the European correspondents get together and talk about some topics that are of particular interest to them, and you'll hear lots of funny accents, and we're going to have a lot of fun with that one. We're doing live radio trivia, which is the original format of radio trivia with TYP, and as much as I love the podcast version and the convenience of having that, the live radio trivia experience is awesome, because it becomes very interactive, and that whole feeling of having the name of that game on the tip of your tongue becomes so palpable when it's in real time. It's awesome. And there will be prizes given out for this and many of the segments that we're doing.
I'll be lending a hand. I'm really excited.
Excellent. Yeah, that is a tradition going back about 10 or 11 years with our website, and I'm just so thrilled that we can find ways to bring back live radio trivia. It's just one of my favorite things in the world. We're going to have a live version of Connectivity's Who Wants to Be a Nintendo Heir, one of the funniest titles for any game show, I think. And that is really, really fun stuff. If you don't listen to Connectivity, you're in for a treat when you hear this. The music alone makes it a very, very thrilling event. And the questions tend to be pretty damn challenging. So that's some more awesome Nintendo trivia there. And don't know yet who's going to be in the hot seat for that, but it might be really fun to see that. And there will be more listener interaction for that. We've got the Famicast coming from Japan. It's an all Japan crew doing live radio, and we have the 8-4 Play team there to help them out. It's going to be spectacular. I cannot wait for that. It was one of the best things that we did last year, and I'm so excited that it's coming back. We've got our friends at Nintendo Free Radio, including Donald, who you heard a couple of weeks ago here on this show, are going to be doing their Nintendo-themed version of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And that's a kind of a comedy game show with panelists, and they're talking about current events. And I don't know what all they're going to talk about. I'm really kind of leaving them to their own devices for the most part. I want it to be their deal. But we did just announce a couple of days ago that Phil and CJ from the Player One podcast are going to be two of the panelists for that segment. So you can really look forward to that. It's going to be awesome. Those guys really know their stuff with Nintendo as well. And we're going to talk about our favorite Nintendo games. That's going to be a topic. We'll probably have a lot of call-ins for that, but we might have some special guests as well come on and share their favorite Nintendo games and talk about them and why it's their favorite and what that stuff means to them. So I think that's going to be really fun as well. And then, of course, Shenanigans, which who knows? Who knows what could happen during Shenanigans? That's at the end of the telethon when we're all totally spent and we're starting to go a little bit crazy. And we have a lot of live call-ins during that segment, and things start to get out of hand, and it's really fun. It's worth looking forward to. So in addition to 8-4 and CJ and Phil from Player One Podcast, we've also got Jeff Callis, our friend from Penny Arcade, who's going to come and talk to us a little bit about what Child's Play does. And he told me he also wanted to talk about Wii U now that he used to work at Nintendo. So I'm sure he has an interesting perspective on it. And last year, man, he was all up in talking about Battlefield being pitched as a GameCube game. And Jeff always has some good stories from the old days at Nintendo, that's for sure. I can also announce that our friend Brad Shoemaker from Giant Bomb is going to be on the telethon. He is a big Nintendo fan as well, and one of my favorite podcasters, has an awesome voice for podcasting, deep voice, and is a superb guy, super awesome guy. So I'm super excited to have Brad on. Our friend Craig Harris from Sega, he's not representing Sega, but that's where he works now. Craig is going to be back. Of course, Craig ran IGN Nintendo for a few years, used to host the IGN Nintendo Voice Chat podcast, and has been a friend and a competitor to our site for many, many years. And he was on last year, and I'm very excited to have Craig back on. He's a fan favorite. Billy, we're not sure about, but as of this moment, he thinks he might be able to come. He really hopes. It's a scheduling matter, so we're hoping our friend Billy Berghammer will be on. And ladies and gentlemen, I'm super, super excited to announce that one of my heroes, Garnet Lee, is going to be on the telethon. And getting Garnet to talk about Nintendo is a special event indeed. So you can really look forward to that. I mean, Garnet is pretty much the reason that I'm here right now talking to you on this show. So I'm super thrilled to have Garnet on. I've been trying to get him on this podcast for many years, and it's never worked out. So I'm just so excited to have him as part of our telethon. So that's it. If you're not pumped now, I don't know what's wrong with you. I mean, this is going to be like the coolest event ever. So it's for a great charity. Come, please donate if you can. But even if you can't, help us spread the word, do a little promotion, tell your friends, your gaming communities, whatnot online. We would really appreciate it. You know, just over Twitter and Facebook, help us spread the word. And that really makes a big difference. And if you can convince one or two people to come and listen to it for even a little bit, it really makes a big difference in the show. It is a really big, complex event to put on. It's a lot of work. It's a ton of fun for everybody. And I really hope you will come in and be a part of it with us. That is on Saturday, November 10th, which should be the very first Saturday after you hear this. And it's going on most of the day. So head over to NintendoWorldReport.com for many more details and to find the chat room and the audio stream and everything else you need to know for the live telethon, the third annual. Man, crazy. I'm out of breath, so let's end the show, guys. Nick, thank you so much. You were a great guest. I really appreciate you helping us out, man.
That's all right. It's been pretty cool to finally get on the show. Like, I've been listening since the show started, so, you know, wow. Fan from back in the day. Wow. And I've listened to 103 awesome. At least four times.
Oh, man. Oh, that's also known as brain damage. So I really appreciate you being here with us.
You gotta laugh at something when you're driving home, you know? Like.
All right, man. Well, thanks so much for being here. And we'll hear from probably you and many, many other people on the telethon next weekend. I'm so excited to talk to everybody. So thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you here in a couple of weeks back on the regular edition of Radio Free Nintendo.
Bye.